Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey everyone, it's Michael. Before we get started, I just want to let you know that we're going to be doing something a little bit different on today's episode of Unresolved. Instead of me telling one story, I'm going to be telling two separate, unrelated stories, which don't have a lot of available information out there about them. I always try and highlight underreported stories on this podcast, and this format will allow me to do that even more by highlighting stories that haven't received much in the way of coverage over the years. First, you'll hear the story of a postal worker who was shot and killed while on duty roughly 11 years ago. And then after the break, you will learn about a young man that disappeared from a behavioral treatment facility more than 3 decades ago. Both have received very little coverage in the years since, and, as always, remain unresolved. Now, here's today's episode. The U.S. Postal Service is an independent agency of the executive branch, which provides postal service to every corner of the country, no matter how isolated or rural. Despite being seen as one of the many extraneous services of government, the USPS is actually one of the few governmental bodies laid out in the U.S. Constitution, with Article 1, Section 8, Clause 7, the Postal Clause, laying out pretty clearly. The Postal Service shall have as its basic function the obligation to provide postal services to bind the nation together through the personal, educational, literary, and business correspondence of the people. From the beginning of the United States as a country, the Postal Service has been a bedrock of government, with noted patriot Benjamin Franklin being appointed the first Postmaster General during the Second Continental Congress in 1775. Despite attempts by many to politicize the Postal Service and its mission, it remains a valuable cornerstone of American life, being how many of us continue to receive goods, medications, meals, and even our voting ballots, and handles as much traffic in just a few weeks as its privatized competitors can handle in an entire year. Through decades of interference and political sabotage, the U.S. Postal Service perseveres. Despite this, though, the Postal Service has not been a stranger to human influences, with the phrase going postal becoming a common expression in the latter half of the 20th century, due to a rash of workplace violence incidents involving postal workers. But today's story doesn't center around that, rather the exact opposite, a public servant whose 2009 death remains clouded in mystery over a decade later. This is the story of Tony Harrelson. By 2009, Tony Wayne Harrelson had entered into a comfortable life with his wife, his children, and his grandchildren. He had been married to his wife, Dina, for several years, and the couple had 6 children, Richard, Dustin, Amy, Jennifer, Brittany, and Jesse. The couple also had 9 grandchildren, although that number has grown in the years since. Born and raised in Dadeville, Alabama, a small town in Tallapoosa County with a population of around 3,200 people, located about 90 miles southeast of Birmingham, Tony was what you would expect from most men in the region. He was a big Alabama football fan. He enjoyed watching NASCAR races, and his favorite hobbies included playing pool with his children and grandchildren, as well as spending time with his wife and the Basset Hounds he was raising. But what really set Tony apart was his sense of humor, with him being able to find the humor in almost anything. According to a former co-worker, James Williams, who had known Tony for decades, quote, "No matter how bad the situation, he would find a way to laugh about it." Despite living in Dadeville, Tony would end up working a lot in the surrounding area as a truck driver for the U.S. Postal Service. This work would end up taking him out to regions like Camp Hill, an even more rural town about 10 miles away from home, where Tony's life would come to a tragic, sudden, and mysterious end. On October 2nd, 2009, sometime between 5:45 and 6:15 p.m., 46-year-old Tony Harrelson was shot and killed at the Camp Hill Post Office, which was and is located in a heavily forested part of town. Police were notified of the shooting with a 911 call that afternoon, but specific details about the crime or the 911 call have never been released to the public. Authorities have not disclosed any details about the crime scene or the crime itself, including details about where the shooting specifically took place, or the circumstances that might have led up to it, but would later reveal that postal property was stolen during the attack. The investigation into this incident would be headed by the U.S. Postal Inspection Service, which is the first time I've said that on this podcast. They would begin to oversee this investigation because Tony was on duty at the time of the shooting, and it's worth pointing out that despite being almost unheard of in most people's lives, the Postal Inspection Service is one of the most respected investigative services in the country, and is actually the oldest continually operating law enforcement agency in America, dating back to the late 18th century. From the inception of the United States, the Postal Inspection Service has been tasked with supporting and protecting not only the mail system, but any crimes that may adversely affect or fraudulently use the U.S. mail, the postal system, or postal employees. The Postal Inspection Service would set up a mobile command center behind the post office in Opelika, Alabama, which would remain active for months after Tony's shooting. They would be joined by members of the Camp Hill Police Department, the Tallapoosa County Sheriff's Department, and the Alabama Bureau of Investigation over the course of their investigation. In an effort to gain the attention of potential witnesses, authorities would engage in a weeks-long public awareness campaign which involved hanging up tens of thousands of flyers throughout the region, and an extensive letter-writing campaign, both of which asked for anyone with information to come forward, no matter how big or small it may seem. They would even begin putting up billboards throughout eastern Alabama months later, hoping that the awareness might knock loose a memory or two from someone that had seen something. Yolanda Burns, a U.S. postal inspector and public information officer, would tell reporters at the time, "We don't want anyone to think that they can commit this kind of offense against a federal employee and get away with it. We need witnesses to come forward who were in the Camp Hill area at the time or days prior to the shooting, who may have noticed any type of suspicious activity in the area." While investigators would never reveal much in the way of details about the crime, the fact that they were never able to ascertain a motive is in itself rather noteworthy. Investigators were unable to find any animosity towards Tony from people in his life, at least nothing that would rise to this level, which seemed to rule out any potential personal motives rather quickly. As I've already stated though, authorities would reveal months after the shooting that postal property had been stolen during the commission of this crime, but would never declare what this was exactly, leaving the possibility open that the offender might have been searching for something of value, or even something in particular. I have discovered that at the time of Tony's murder, the Camp Hill Post Office did a surprising number of money order transactions each day. In case you're not familiar with money orders, they are basically certified checks. People would bring in their money or their paychecks, and then transfer this money into money orders in order to pay bills or make payments. This made up a surprisingly good chunk of the Camp Hill facility's business at the time. But, of course, debit cards and other digital payment methods have changed that over the past 11 years. On the day of Tony's murder, October 2nd, a large amount of cash was going to be moved from the Camp Hill location, and it's possible that his killers knew that. To me, this would indicate some familiarity with that post office, or at least some kind of a loose connection, and would become noteworthy because of additional information released by authorities. Months after Tony's murder, authorities would reveal that a string of armed robberies had taken place at post offices throughout Alabama, some of which bore significant similarities to Tony's murder. The first robbery had taken place in Smith Station, Alabama, about 40 miles southwest of Camp Hill, on July 23rd, 2008. In that case, from about a year prior to Tony's murder, an armed gunman had approached the driver of a postal truck at around 6 p.m., demanding several postal bags and then fleeing from the scene with an undisclosed amount of cash. Before leaving, though, the gunman would lock up the driver in the back of the truck, who was found several hours later, in the early morning hours of July 24th. The driver would later describe this gunman in pretty average terms, stating that he stood about 6 feet tall, weighed about 190 pounds, and was wearing a white shirt and blue jeans, as well as sunglasses and a bandana, which obscured his facial features. Subsequent robberies that were later linked to this would take place in Troy in August of 2008 and Hope Hull in December of 2009, with authorities stating that these crimes could be related, having perhaps been carried out by an opportunist that simply felt no remorse. Perhaps Tony had been the only driver to push back against this gunman and had been shot as a result. With this crime spree coming to a supposed end in December of 2009, just months after Tony's murder, it was theorized that the persons responsible may have fled the state, with U.S. Postal Inspector Tony Robinson later warning the offender of this crime through the press. Running to the next state isn't going to help. We'll just follow them there too. One year after Tony's death, a vigil would be held at the Camp Hill post office to remember the person that he had been. Friends and family would gather to recall memories about the 46-year-old, whose shocking death had left many of them adrift, including Tony's widow, Dina, who spoke to reporters with the Alex City Outlook, stating, "We just want everyone to remember, and him not be forgotten." Roughly 2 years after Tony's death, Dina would file a suit against the U.S. Postal Service, claiming that it had done an inadequate job in protecting its employees. In her suit, she hoped to seek changes as well as $2 million in damages due to Tony's murder, but the case was dismissed in 2012, with Judge Charles S. Coody dismissing the case with prejudice, citing the U.S. government's argument of sovereign immunity. And that is, unfortunately, where the story just kind of ends. A few stories would come out about this case in 2018 and 2019, as the 10-year mark of Tony's murder came and went, but that's virtually it. If the persons responsible for Tony's death are ever caught, their punishment will likely vary between one of two possibilities: death or life imprisonment, which are the two punishments set aside in the U.S. Penal Code for those that commit murder against an officer or employee of the Postal Service. That would, of course, depend on the circumstances of the case and which murder charge they would receive, first or second degree, and would depend on the details of their capture and how cooperative they are with authorities. It's also worth pointing out that a $100,000 reward exists for any information that might lead to an arrest, including information about anyone that might have been an accessory to this crime, might have conspired with the killers, or had received any items stolen during the murder. If you know anything at all, or simply think that you might know something, I would advise that you reach out, if only to make yourself rich. If it's proven that Tony's murder is related to the other robberies from the region, the three robberies from Smith Station, Troy, and Hope Hull, Alabama, then the reward can reach as high as $300,000. That is how eager the USPS is to bring a resolution to this case and obtain justice for Tony and his loved ones. If you know anything and would like to claim this hefty reward, then please reach out to the U.S. Postal Inspection Service at 877-876-2455. You can also reach out to the Tallapoosa Sheriff's Department at 256-825-4264, or the Secret Witness number at 256-827-2035, if you would like to remain anonymous. I would like to end this episode with words spoken by Tony's best friend, Reverend James Williams, who spoke at Tony's vigil on the one-year mark of his death. Tony Harrelson was not just my very best friend in the whole world. He was also a father. He was also a husband. He was a son. He was a grandpa. He was a brother. He was an uncle. He was a cousin. He was somebody's co-worker. So you see, it's when you think about him in this way, there's no way that he's ever going to become a number or a statistic. As of this episode's recording, the story of Tony Harrelson remains unresolved. Now, we're going to pause for just a moment to hear a word from today's sponsors.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law.
See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Today's episode is also brought to you by SimpliSafe. Here's the thing about home security companies. Most trap you with high prices, tricky contracts, and lousy customer support. And while there are a lot of options out there, there's only one no-brainer. SimpliSafe. When I got SimpliSafe, I was able to set it all up within an hour. The packages come with all of the equipment and instructions necessary to set it up yourself, and they make it as easy as possible to secure your home, so that you can feel comfortable every time you leave, or even when you're at home and want to relax. And something I really enjoy, their systems are made with pets in mind, so you can set everything up so that you don't have to worry about false alarms in the middle of the night or anything like that. SimpliSafe has got everything you need to protect your home with none of the drawbacks of traditional home security. No sketchy or pushy salespeople, no contracts, and best of all, no hidden fees or fine print. And it all starts at $15 a month, making it the most affordable option for home security. To get a free HD camera for your home security system, try SimpliSafe at simplisafe.com/unresolved. You have nothing to lose by at least trying it, so once again, head to simplisafe.com/unresolved to learn more and get your free HD camera. That's simplisafe.com/unresolved. Now, let's return to the show. Robert Thomas Pilsen Rayer was born on October 27, 1974, and would spend the first few years of his life with his mother, Jean, in Arizona. From an early age, Robert would begin to express a number of emotional issues, which seemed to have stemmed from a tragedy Robert experienced firsthand, the suicide of his stepfather. When he was just a child, Robert's mom met a man named Gerald, who was a disabled Vietnam War veteran. Gerald would become Robert's stepfather, and would end up having one child with Robert's mother, a boy that was just a few years younger than Robert, named Jerry Jr. Robert and his stepfather would end up becoming incredibly close, but due to his own issues stemming from his combat experience, namely his physical disabilities, which left him bound to a wheelchair and resentful, Gerald would make the decision to take his own life when Robert was just 7 years old. Robert would actually end up walking into the house just moments after the fatal gunshot, witnessing the deceased body of the only father he had ever known. In the wake of this tragedy, Robert would end up blaming himself for his father's death, despite him having been one of the bright spots in Gerald's life. From this point forward, Robert would begin to express a lot of understandable yet troubling behavior, which manifested itself in aggressive and emotional outbursts over the next several years. Shortly after the tragic loss of his stepfather, Robert would move with his mother and brother to Colorado Springs, with the family hoping to start anew. It was shortly after this, though, that Robert began to be bullied in his new school for being overweight, and this was later exacerbated by Robert being put into special education classes due to his ongoing behavioral issues. Robert would end up becoming resentful of his fellow classmates and himself, blaming himself for his father's death and his inability to make or keep any friends. It's even reported that Robert was beginning to contemplate self-harm as he entered his teenage years, and the bullying at school started to reach a head when he injured another kid in a schoolyard fight. After this, Robert would be sent to a behavioral treatment facility named Cheyenne Mesa, which was known in the Colorado Springs area for dealing with adolescents who were experiencing behavioral or psychiatric issues. While Robert's issues weren't quite at the psychiatric level, it was impossible to ignore what was becoming evidently problematic. Robert's mother, Jean, hoped that him being treated at the facility would end up straightening out the youth, but this was little more than a pipe dream, with the youth's behavior deteriorating after a short stay at the facility in 1990, and him becoming even more defiant in the aftermath. Now 15 years old, Robert was becoming more headstrong and stubborn, and his outbursts were becoming even more pronounced. He would even run away from home briefly, with these issues continuing to express themselves in troubling ways throughout the year. Ultimately, state authorities would weigh in on the matter, threatening to take Robert into their custody unless he returned to a behavioral treatment facility for more long-term care. This would force Robert back into the confines of the Cheyenne Mesa facility in June of 1990, where he would end up staying for the next several weeks. On the morning of July 6th, 1990, Robert would call his mother, Jean. The two made it a point to speak every day while the teen was away from home, and almost all of their prior conversations had been pretty normal mother-son talk. The conversation this morning, however, felt different. During their conversation that morning, Robert would hint at something being wrong. However, when asked, he would refrain from saying what exactly was wrong, telling his mother through what sounded like tears that their call was being monitored, and he was unable to speak plainly about what was going on. As Jean would later recall, Robert told her, "They monitor the phones. Mom, I've got to talk to you." As their conversation ended, Robert hinted at running away from the facility because the current conditions were just that bad. Almost immediately after their phone call, Jean would call back the Cheyenne Mesa Adolescent Treatment Facility and would make arrangements to visit as soon as possible. However, during her call, she was told that Robert was going to be unavailable for the rest of the day, as he had plans to go off campus with some staff members and other students. So any plans for Jean to visit would have to wait until after he returned. Jean was expecting a callback from the facility, from Robert, later that day. When it finally came, it wasn't her son on the other end of the phone, but employees from Cheyenne Mesa. This is when she received the news that any parent would fear, the news that the location of her child was currently unknown. Employees at Cheyenne Mesa claimed that Robert Pilson Rayer had run away on July 6th, 1990 of his own accord. However, unfortunately, it does not seem like much of an investigation ever took place. Despite authorities registering Robert as a missing person at the time, it doesn't seem like they ever investigated the case as a potential homicide or kidnapping, despite there not being any sign of life in over 3 decades. In fact, when I filed a FOIA request for any information regarding this case, the outright denied it after letting it sit in their system for almost an entire year. This, paired with what we know of the case, leads me to believe that the police never took this investigation seriously, and don't have a lot of information about Robert as a result. We do know that a couple of Cheyenne Mesa employees claimed to be the last known people to see Robert on or around their campus on the morning of July 6th. One employee claimed that they last saw Robert when he was laying in the middle of a field on the facility's grounds that morning, at around 8:45, while another claims to have spotted him leaving the facility later that day. This employee claims that they did not try and stop Robert, citing his size and weight at the time, 180 pounds, as well as his known behavioral issues. But this same employee would later tell police when questioned, "Maybe Bobby didn't make it. Maybe he is dead." The time frame that these employees gave for Robert leaving the campus, during the morning hours of July 6th, 1990, happened to correlate to when he was speaking to his mother, Jean, on the telephone. Later, when Robert's clothing and belongings were returned to his mother, she would note that the clothing that staff members had reported him wearing on the day he disappeared, a blue plaid shirt and black jeans, were mixed in with the rest. This implied that he had not been wearing them when he supposedly ran away, and the same could be said for his shoes. Along with Robert's clothing, which had been returned to his mother, were both pairs of shoes that he had taken with him to the facility. This indicated that he had been barefoot at the time of his disappearance, which was another point against him having voluntarily run away. In the days after Robert's disappearance, his mother Jean would end up making repeated calls to Cheyenne Mesa, hoping to get to the bottom of whatever had happened to her son. But after just 3 days, employees at the facility told her to stop calling them, claiming that she was harassing them and that they were going to get the police police involved if she kept at it. Mind you, these were the people that had last seen her son alive and had become his legal caretakers during his government-mandated stay at their facility. But now, just 3 days after his disappearance, these same people were claiming that he was no longer their responsibility, since, according to them, he had run away, and it doesn't seem like any legal authority was pushing back against their claims. All of this information would end up haunting Jean, Robert's mother, for decades. She would later claim that the weekend before his disappearance, Robert had come home for a visit and had brought home some dirty laundry. While doing his laundry, she had noticed some blood in his underwear but thought nothing of it at the time. Now, after his disappearance, she began to fear that he had been sexually abused while at Cheyenne Mesa, in particular by the staff members that supervised him on a regular basis and were monitoring his phone calls. The same people that had reported him missing hours after he had last been seen alive, only because Jean had been expecting a call. However, because there wasn't a push by detectives to figure out where this missing and troubled teen was, any hopes of finding an answer seemed to have fallen by the wayside in the months and years after Robert's disappearance. The Cheyenne Mesa Adolescent Treatment Facility would end up closing its doors for good just a handful of years later. The facility had become financially insolvent just a few years after Robert's disappearance, and the grounds would ultimately be sold to new owners in 1997, who attempted to revive the facility under new management, but that seems to have never come to fruition. Police in Colorado Springs would eventually reclassify Robert's case years later, changing his status from runaway to endangered missing, but continue to state that there was no evidence of foul play in his disappearance. It appears like Robert's mother Jean now resides in Kansas, but continues to look for her missing son, who has now been missing more than twice as long as he was ever with her and the rest of his loved ones. In 2010, Jean would tell reporters that she remembers Robert's disappearance, quote, like it was yesterday. You never get over it. You're always looking. You're always looking at people's faces. Jean continues to hold out hope that Robert is still alive out there, somewhere, safe and sound, but she believes that those who worked at Cheyenne Mesa know much more than they ever told police. Speaking to Denver Post reporter Kirk Mitchell in 2014, she stated, "There has been absolute silence. I don't understand the dead silence. It's not him. I know him. If he ran away, he would have called. There is no way he would run away without any shoes." Robert Pilsen Rayer was just 15 years old when he disappeared in July of 1990. He would now be approaching his 46th birthday just later this month, in October of 2020. You can find age progression photos of Robert online, at the Unresolved website, or on the Instagram page, to see what Robert might have looked like as an adult. It's worth noting that Robert had a scar on his forehead, and a discoloration on his right arm, as well as a burn on the top of his right hand, and scars on the last two toes of his right foot. He was wearing wire-rimmed glasses at the time of his disappearance, and might still need corrective lenses or contacts. If any of this sounds familiar, please contact the Colorado Springs Police Department at 719-444-7000. Once again, that's 719-444-7000. There will hopefully be an update in this case in the near future, but until such a time, the story of Robert Pilsen Rayer will remain unresolved. Thank you for listening to this episode of Unresolved. I hope you all enjoyed today's format, which reminds me of the unsolved mysteries of old. I really enjoyed getting to highlight some little-known stories, and this short stories format is definitely something that I'll be revisiting in the near future. I have been your host, Michael Whelan. This episode of the show was researched, written, and produced by myself, and the music throughout this episode was put together by yours truly through Amper Music. The song you're hearing right now is the Unresolved theme song, which was written and composed by Ilsa Traves. For a full list of sources and references, please head to the podcast website at unresolved.me to learn more. If you enjoyed this episode, then you might enjoy the Patreon exclusives, just one of the many perks that you can find on the Unresolved Patreon page. To learn more about how you can support this show and hear these bonus episodes, please head to patreon.com/unresolvedpod, no spaces or dashes or anything, or just search for Unresolved on the Patreon app. Now, I would like to take a moment to thank the producers of this episode, who support this show each month through Patreon. Roberta Jansen, Ben Crocombe, Gabriella Bromley, Peggy Ballarda, Quill Carter, Laura Hannon, Damian Moore, Brittany Norris, Amy Hampton, Stephen Wilson, Scott Nisi, Marie Vangland, Scott Patzold, Astrid Nyer, Travis Sepko, Aime McGregor, Sydney Scotton, Sarah Moscaritolo, Sue Kirk, Thomas Ahern, Brian Hall, Seth Morgan, Marion Welsh, Joe Wong, Patrick Loxo, Alyssa Lawton, Meadow Landry, Tatum Bautista, Tunye Elzinga, Michelle Watson, Ryan Green, Stephanie Joyner, Don Keller, and Alyssa Hampton Dutrow. Thank you all so, so much. For the record, I've been meaning to ship out another batch of Patreon swag for a couple of months now, but my recent cross-country move has really made that aggravating and impossible, as I seem to have lost the big box of merchandise that I had packed away beforehand. Just so you know though, I've placed another order of stickers, magnets, and coasters, but I've yet to receive them because of some COVID shipping restrictions, so I'm honestly sorry everyone. I know some of you have been waiting for your swag for a few months now, but hopefully you will be getting it very, very soon. I do apologize that it's taken so long, but I can guarantee that it will be coming soon. Anyhow, I will be back with another full-length episode next week. Until then, I hope you all stay safe, stay healthy, and please, everyone out there, please remember to vote. Take care.